The general picture in the international press is that there's been a very broad popular reaction against Ukraine's refusal to associate with the European Union. That is the beginning of the story, but the story has a much broader context and a much deeper quality. Ukraine in the 20th century was a territory of mass murder and terror, a kind of crucible of the totalitarian experiments, both in their brown Nazi and red communist forms. About 17 million people were killed in Ukraine through the two world wars, through the different purges of the political, intellectual, cultural elite. In 1932-33, between 5, maybe 7 million peasants were starved to death artificially to break their resistance to Soviet rule. That was followed by World War II and the Holocaust. Millions of people were deported to Siberia. In many places, every fourth, fifth citizen was coerced to be an informant to the KGB. So besides the physical fear, there was a prevailing atmosphere of distrust and fear about information. It's really kind of a ransom society where people hold information on you and threaten to use information against you, whether it's your private information, your financial information, or otherwise, to manipulate your activity. This atmosphere of fear and its intimidation is what the Maidan is reacting against. It's reacting as well against wanton corruption in the country. A mother with a child who is sick goes to a hospital, and she has to figure out whom she needs to bribe to get emergency medical care. Parents pay bribes so that their children get grades in school. Students pay bribes for exams at the university. It's all over the society at all different levels, and people are morally exhausted. So this Maidan movement, and Maidan means square in Ukrainian, began as a Euro-Maidan movement, but it really is now a Maidan of dignity, a Maidan of citizens recognizing something that is rather transcendental. And something that is fundamentally spiritual, that every person is created with dignity in the image and likeness of God. Millions of people have participated. On one day alone, on December 8th, there were probably about 800,000 people in the square area, the capital in Kyiv. And people from all parts of the country have been coming into the capital. But also these Maidans, these squares, have been functioning in many towns in Ukraine. And in fact, in many cities where Ukrainians are resident internationally, so Rome, Paris, Geneva, Berlin, Brussels, London, in Australia, North America, South America, there's been support in Asia. And what is really happening is that after 20-odd years of independence, Ukraine is maybe halfway in the pilgrimage from the land of captivity to the promised land. Dropping the cloak of slavery is not easy. The biblical 40 years is really a representation of a very objective process. In Ukraine, many of the aspects of Soviet society, of the totalitarian attempt to control not only people do, but what they say and what they think, is only slowly being pushed aside. And the old system and those who have come to use the old system in a new way are putting up great resistance. There is great financial, economic discrepancy that has developed with members of the government taking over large sectors of industry and the economy in general. People are dispossessed. Many of the people don't have anything more to lose, but also the middle class, which has been developing, is actively involved and maybe leading this movement. Almost two-thirds of the people on the Maidan have university-level degrees, and 92% of the people on the Maidan have come there of their own initiative. So it's a popular movement. Not stimulated from the outside. It's kind of a spontaneous coming together of people around principles, not political slogans, and not political personalities or political parties, which is different from the Orange Revolution in 2004, which was a revolution against a falsified presidential election. Today, this movement is a movement of principles and, first of all, a movement of dignity, with a very strong presence of spiritual issues and explicit spiritual language and behavior.
On that note, can you share with us then how the church or the churches in Ukraine are involved in this popular movement?
Basically, the churches have come to where the people ask them to be. You can imagine if 800,000 people are present someplace, somebody's going to die, maybe somebody's going to be born. People want to pray. People want to talk about spiritual things. And so there have been hundreds of priests from different confessions, primarily from the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Kievan Patriarchate, but also from the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate, of the Ukrainian Autocephalous Orthodox Church, from the Roman Catholic Church, from Protestant communions. There has also been at times a Jewish presence, and the Muslim Tatars are present. And the churches have acted in accord at different points. At the main assemblies that occur on Sundays, they are open with an ecumenical prayer. In the evening, in the night, which when there is greatest concern for an attack by riot troops, which has happened a few times already with many, many serious injuries, there is prayer on the hour through the night, led in an ecumenical way from the podium. On December 10th, the All-Ukrainian Council of Churches and Religious Organizations issued a joint declaration which basically had 4 points. One is that the president should listen to the people. Second, that there should be no violence against the protesters, but also that the protesters should resist any provocations to violence. The third point of this joint declaration was a summons not to divide the country. There have been efforts on the part of some establishment political figures, and this was part of the political methodology during the elections of the current president, to divide the country, to speak of different Ukraines, to pit one part of Ukraine against another part. And fourth, encouraging everybody to participate in dialogue. So there is a joint platform, and there is a presence of different churches, some more than others, in the square with the people. At different times, religious services are celebrated. There are ecclesial tents, kind of little refuges where people can light a candle in front of an icon and pray quietly, or access themselves to confession, to spiritual guidance. And this is a phenomenon that characterizes the Maidan in Kyiv, but not only in Kyiv. So the church, following the basic insight expressed by Pope Francis, is trying to make sure that the pastors have the smell of the sheep.
Now, in the midst of all of this, the church has received, at least the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, received a letter, for example, from the Ministry of Culture threatening to interrupt its activities because of its involvement with this popular movement. As well, there were talks of students, university students, receiving threats of intimidation from police officials. What is the church's response to these tactics of intimidation on the church and on the protesters themselves?
Well, what the Ministry of Culture wrote, and the Ministry of Culture is responsible for religious affairs in Ukraine, is that the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, because of the participation of clergy in services in public venues, might be deprived of its legal status. That is a very serious threat expressed to a church that for much of the 20th century, by the powers that be, was outlawed. The Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church from 1945 to 1989 was the biggest illegal church in the world. And at the same time, it was the biggest body of social resistance in the Soviet Union. There was no other institution in the 11 time zones of the Soviet Union that was so present, because so many of the faithful of the church were exiled to Siberia. So they were spread out through the whole span of the Soviet Union. The church included people from all walks of life, and all of its bishops in 1945 were imprisoned. There wasn't collaboration with the regime. When the church came out of the underground in 1989, it had 300 aged priests with an average age of about 70 years. Today, the church has 3,000 priests in Ukraine, or priests that have now gone from Ukraine to minister elsewhere. The church has developed dramatically. It had three bishops in 1900. Today, it has 45 bishops. It had three dioceses in Ukraine. Today, it has 12 dioceses and exarchates. It is a minority church of about 5 million, between 4 and 5 million faithful in a country of 46 million people. However, because of its free and dignified stance in the Soviet times, it emerged into the period of Ukrainian independence with unique moral authority, which has been strengthened by outstanding leadership. Cardinal Lyubomir Huzar and his Beatitude Svyatoslav Shevchuk, the new head of the church, are recognized moral authorities in the country, not only because of their position, but because of their personality. And anybody that wants to control civil society needs to somehow control the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church. That's what Stalin realized in 1945. And today, when the UGCC is the biggest constituent element of civil society, non-government society in Ukraine, it exerts a very big influence regarding such issues as dignity, freedom, justice, equality before the law. The church speaks about these principles because they are the principles of our Savior, the principles of the gospel and the universal Catholic Church. It speaks in terms of the Catholic social doctrine, and it has been quite articulate over the last 20 years in developing language and argument and doctrine addressing the very specific Ukrainian concerns. So this threat about the delegalization of Ukrainian Catholics because they are in the square is taken very seriously. There has been a significant limitation on the freedom of the press, and some analysts believe that there may be a move to limit the freedom of religion. Now, the president disavowed this understanding, and the Minister of Culture has scrambled to say, no, we're not going to delegalize the Ukrainian Catholic Church. But because there have been so many promises and violence has repeatedly emerged and reemerged, many people in protest activities are being beaten and otherwise harassed throughout the country. At the Ukrainian Catholic University, many of our students have been intimidated by phone calls from the Secret Services or the police or the state attorney's office. One must realize that in a country where so many people were killed, so many people were sent to Siberia, so many people were spied on, a call from the Secret Services to the student's personal telephone is a very invasive action that creates great trepidation, insecurity. The fear in Ukraine is only skin deep, and you scratch the surface and it pops out. Because the system killed systematically, people are afraid of the system. This movement of the Maidan is actually a response to this fear, and it's a casting aside of this fear, and that's why there is so much song and dance in the movement. It is a celebratory movement. It celebrates life, and it tries to put aside this almost genomic fear that characterizes Ukrainian society.
Pope Francis expressed his solicitude and his prayers for peace for Ukraine. Are there ways that others can express solidarity with the struggle of the people in Ukraine today?
It is very important to pray. This movement really is a miracle, and much in recent Ukrainian history is miraculous. I gave you the statistics on the number of priests in the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church. In 25 years, it has gone from 300 to 3,000. This church has, for its almost 5 million faithful, has 800 seminarians today. It is growing. This is not the fruit of a pastoral project or some very effective ecclesial strategy. This is grace. This is the blood of the martyrs becoming the seed of faith. And I would like to encourage all listeners to really pray and trust that God works and God hears, God listens, and we're summoned to participate in that conversation in a very concrete way, asking for the things that the world needs. And I ask people to ask for what Ukraine needs. It needs peace. It needs conversion, because the corruption is not only something that goes from top down. People in Ukraine who don't trust the system go around the system. Poverty breeds corruption, and fear breeds corruption. And so there needs to be an across-the-board process of spiritual conversion and a claiming and owning of God-given dignity, of freedom from fear. This is something that only grace ultimately can provide. It is very important for concerned people to be informed. Today, there's so much, excuse my directness, garbage in the news that we miss the real dramatic stories in the world. We pay attention to people who are famous because they are famous, but we don't see the real life stories in the world. Today in Ukraine, a real life story is developing. Ukraine is a country that is a linchpin, kind of a cornerstone of Europe. It is actually, by certain measures, the heart of Europe is in Ukraine. The geographical center of Ukraine is in the Carpathian Mountains. We have forgotten often in the West, in the greater world, that much of Europe is outside the European community. Ukraine, Belarus, European Russia, these are vast expanses of land with 150 million people. We need to understand this part of the world. Without Ukraine, Russia is not an empire. And there's an incredible effort on the part of President Putin and Russian society to reestablish an empire and therefore reabsorb Ukraine. This is, of course, of great geopolitical import. Today, Russia has a threatening attitude. And in Ukraine, there is direct intervention of Russian television, media, money, and political actors who simply come to Ukraine and tell Ukrainians who they should vote for in a way that is unpardonable in most democratic countries. It's important to be informed about spiritual life, the moral questions, and the political context. And it is important to speak out and support. The church in Ukraine needs your solidarity. It needs listeners to write, to voice their concerns to their own church leaders, to politicians, to express solidarity with people who are standing in freezing cold. The Ukrainian winter is bitter. And through the night, tens of thousands of people have been standing to witness to the value of human dignity. When they know that people in different countries are with them in prayer, in solidarity, in explicit expression, they are supported by this. Finally, it's important to realize, this is my profound conviction, people in Ukraine want to join Europe not only to get, not only to have a better economic life, not only to have just courts and a just legal system, not only to have better medical care and to get rid of corruption, but Ukrainians have much to offer. This experience of the 20th century in which people of faith and other people of goodwill stood up to the greatest human challenge, the challenge of totalitarianism, this school of faith has much to offer to Western Europe and to the broader international and ecclesial community. I was raised and grew up in the United States, but I spent the last 20 years in Ukraine, and my faith was very much inspired by what I encountered in the Confessing Church, in the church that stood up to communism and to Nazi rule. And this is really a story of inspiration. And I think Ukraine and the church in Ukraine has a great responsibility to share this story. And I encourage listeners to be open, inquiring, to stand in solidarity, to support morally and materially the church in Ukraine. Today, this church is growing, and I am convinced that it has a vocation to help the universal church in ways that are still unknown.